This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. This is a program that does not necessarily reflect the KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents' opinions or views. I'm David Letourneau. I'm your host for In the Garden. In today's topic, we have permaculture. And my guest is Susan Krings. She's a UCC Master Gardener from the Riverside Master Gardening area. And Susan is a expert in permaculture. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, David. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you here as well. I'm excited about this topic. I've heard about permaculture, but I can never really explain it to people. So we'll get into that.
Yeah, it's a really big topic. But you did take a lecture or a course of some sort, didn't you?
That's what piqued my interest. Was I was in a Holy Nativity. It's a church in Westchester, California, near Los Angeles Airport. They have this fantastic community garden, and they utilize the permaculture approach.
Nice.
Which was great. And they donate, I think it's like 2,000 to 3,000 pounds of produce to the LAX food pantry every year.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it's a really great thing. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Susan, so we have an idea of where you've got this knowledge
from. Okay. All right. Well, I was in fitness for 17 years, and one of the things that I did as a fitness professional is counsel my clients on nutrition. But I found that a lot of people would struggle with finding organic food or that they didn't want to spend the extra money on it because, you know, back in the day it was pretty expensive when it just first started coming around. So I said, well, let's start to grow our own food. And so I started looking about, you know, researching organic gardening. And suddenly I realized, well, there are all these techniques out there, but I really don't even know how plants grow. I can plant a seed. Where am I going to put this in my landscape? How am I going to plant it? Am I going to use a pot or am I going to dig a hole in the yard? Do I need tree crops or annual crops? So I started looking at design, how to design the garden, and then permaculture popped up.
Sure.
And it really blew my mind just from the get-go. I learned about Bill Mollison, who's the father of permaculture, and I learned about Jeff Lawton, who is one of his direct students and has been teaching for about 30 years. And I just gobbled it up. I couldn't get enough.
Yes. It's interesting because it piqued my interest when I heard about it, but I haven't been able to really pursue it. And then I ran across you at a gardening event in Palm Springs.
Yeah, we were down at UC Riverside doing our annual garden day.
Right.
For the master gardeners down there.
And that's something that if you haven't done, you should think about going to that. I think it was in September?
October.
October.
Yeah.
Okay. But could you briefly describe to our listeners what permaculture is all about? You know, I have different ideas. I try to explain it. And I think a lot of us actually utilize some of the techniques. It's just that we haven't combined them all to get that permaculture result.
Yeah, a lot of people know how to garden, and intuitively they'll be using some of the things that we use in permaculture, but permaculture is really, it's a design science. So we learn how to do so many different things and we put it all together into a system that we try to learn from nature and we try to mimic nature because nature is the expert on gardening and growing things and harvesting energy from the sun. So it's really a design science for sustainable human settlement, and gardening is just one part of that.
So you're integrating all these various aspects of what nature has really been doing for eons.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're incorporating obviously food, the energy. You know, I'm stumbling here a little bit.
Well, we're trying to, you know, every living thing needs energy, you know, and so we're all trying to capture that energy from the sun in the form of food to keep our bodies going, in the form of fuel, maybe fossil fuel to keep our cars going, in the case of maybe some wind energy or solar energy in order to keep our houses, you know, full of electricity. So we're trying to capture this energy, and that's really what gardening is all about. And that's what the founder of permaculture, Bill Mollison, said, and also Jeff Lawton, his student, They go, you know, all the world's problems can be solved in a garden because this is where we start to learn how to capture this energy from the sun and to grow our own food, to grow our own fuel if we would want to, you know, have wood fire, and to fuel our gardens with compost and recycling those nutrients back into the system.
So this approach is really almost a holistic living in harmony with nature.
Absolutely.
As well as applying the technologies that we have to maximize, I guess, our effectiveness and our yields. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because technology can be really high tech. It can be the latest cutting edge technology that we have in the digital age, or it can be something as simple as an old school water wheel. You know, it doesn't have to, we call it appropriate technology. It's whatever works by doing the least amount of change or implementation for the most amount of good.
So where would you start as a, there's, maybe explain to us, there's several levels of permaculture that people could be aware of and maybe even do from an industrialized approach, from a community approach. One of the things that I learned when I was at this seminar was that they were taking this technique and bringing it into communities throughout the world to help people have a sustainable food source.
Mm-hmm.
Because what a lot of these folks would do is they would have a monocrop of,
right,
let's say, coffee. And
they were dependent. Yeah, it's their cash crop.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And they're dependent. Trying to make some
money. Totally on that crop. So
mm-hmm.
you get a year that you've got a bum crop or bad crop, and people now have no monies to buy food or
right.
buy the things that they need.
So used to, like in the past, these communities would have had their gardens and their traditional plants and medicines that they grew so that they could take care of themselves. But then they got the idea, wow, we should get into the modern world and we should do agriculture and get on the world market and do, you know, trade, because we should capitalize on this crop that we can grow and make money on. But what happened is it wiped out all of their traditional foods and medicines. So now, you know, they're trying to get back into learning how to grow these things that used to be just passed down from generation to generation. You know, at this point, since probably, you know, the 60s or 70s really, when big ag came in, you know, we've got a few generations between now and then, and so people have forgotten, so they're having to relearn.
Right. And I think from what I saw in this presentation, the fact that it's not just garden crops that they're growing, it's the utilization of water and how it's conserved and
mm-hmm.
how it's incorporated into even aquaponics, where they might have a little pond where they have fish that they're growing.
Yeah.
There's probably even more to this than I'm able to explain, so I'll let you.
Well, but yeah, that's all part of it. It's how do we integrate all of our resources so that we create a system that works together? Because what we don't want is waste products. And, you
right.
know, if you have a monoculture of anything, whether it's, you know, a growing system of a certain crop or a manufacturing process of a certain item, usually that produces a lot of waste that then either has to be hauled off somewhere to a landfill or sold and transported. So what we want to do with permaculture is effectively and efficiently incorporate that right back into the system. And that includes all the water that we might use to process something. So if it's a little bit dirty, say we've rinsed some vegetables or, you know, washed something in it, we can throw it right back out onto a tree, and that tree, the soil can clean the water, the nutrients that are in that water from, you know, getting used, goes right back into the system. Same with any type of extra product that we might get from an animal, you know, it's waste products. How can we put that right back into the system without
right.
creating a pollution?
Right. And it brings to mind for me one of my subjects I'm really intrigued with is mulching, for example.
Yeah.
So that's all part of that, because you're taking materials, organic materials typically, and you're allowing that to decompose and then reapply it again. So it's kind of that circle of life, as you will.
Mm-hmm.
But how would a home gardener utilize this method, and what kind of design elements are you looking at? I picture this being a situation where I could convert my front lawn to a permaculture system that would look attractive yet provide the benefit of producing fruits and vegetables and not wasting the water on grass that just is purely aesthetic.
You know, all plants have, well, I would say most plants have value for us. You know, even grass placed in the right position has a cooling effect, both emotionally and physically in the environment. But if you're, you know, you're planting that one monocrop of grass throughout your whole property, then that becomes, you know, a heavily, you know, you have to put heavy inputs into that in order to keep it going and looking like you want it to look. So how can we get diversity into our property while experiencing or gaining a yield from that property? You know, more than just that cooling effect of the grass or the big area where you can play or have your kids or your dogs run around. How can we incorporate some trees for shade and for fruit production? And how can we get some flowers in there to make it look pretty and some vegetables for us to eat?
So if you were to approach this, what's your objective? I mean, we talked about, obviously, you're saving water, you're utilizing the space more efficiently, maybe for cooling. Mm-hmm. But if I were to start with a landscape design, for example.
Okay.
Because one of the ideas I got from this lecture that I saw was that your home is sort of the middle of a concentric circle, if you will. And there are different areas that you would go out to.
So you're talking about the zoning system of permaculture.
Okay.
Yeah. So in permaculture, we break it down into zones. So you can be in a tiny little environment like a pot that you want to grow some vegetables in, or you could take it to your urban property with your house and your front yard and your backyard, or you could take it to a small farm. But what we want to identify is the five zones. Like zone one is pretty much what is right outside your back door. What's the easiest to get to and what takes the most energy to maintain? Well, that would be your annual vegetable garden for most people.
So the objective with that first zone is to, it's going to require a little more maintenance potentially or a little more care.
Yeah.
So you're hitting that right as you go out the door of your home.
Yes.
And then as you go farther out into the other zones, those zones require less attention.
Less and less attention, yes. So zone two would be larger systems. And, you know, urban properties will not have all five zones typically, and it's really up to the homeowner about how many and which zones they want to incorporate. But typically you could have a zone two, and that could be where you maybe put your mini orchard or your little tiny food forest. And that, you know, because trees don't take as much attention. And so you can put those out a little further. You can visit them once a week instead of every day like you would need to visit your vegetable garden in zone one. Most urban properties are definitely not going to have a zone three, which is for pasture, if you were going to have some grazing animals or if you were going to grow a main carbohydrate crop like corn or soybeans or hay or something. But then you could have a zone four. Maybe there's a corner of your property where you just want to have like a nut tree, which you really rarely have to visit. Or you want to grow a few trees for some poles. You could cut off the tree at the base and have it regrow poles so that you could use that for building material. So that would be your zone four, very seldomly visited. Zone five, now everybody could have a little tiny zone five, and that's your nature corridor. Things that you just leave for nature to visit. Maybe you set up a bird bath there or dedicate one tall tree because you want to attract some owls, you know, for some rodent,
control.
Yeah, control, absolutely. You definitely want the tall trees for the owls to come in. But if you have small animals, then you got to watch that too because they might pick up a kitten or a small dog.
I know. I've seen seen videos
it's,
and
it's
whatnot.
It's sad.
It is bad.
Yeah,
it is bad.
Sad.
So, so you have these different zones, and obviously, with most homes in this area, we have limited space as far as trying to maybe go as extensive as you're talking about with the zone five. But I'm trying to figure out where you'd have probably the two zones, but then what else are you doing? What are you trying to be aware of as you plant these things?
Well, I guess the first thing that people have to be aware of and really have to consider is you need to spend a lot of time thinking exactly about what you want to grow and produce on your property. Right. You know, and you don't want to produce a lot of stuff. Now, I know people who go, look at all this produce I'm making and growing and I can share, but you have to understand that it takes a lot of time and energy and resources the more that you grow. So try to figure out exactly what you like, your tastes and preferences, your family, and how much of each thing that you will actually eat.
Right.
And don't go over that, especially in the beginning, because you're going to be learning. You're going to have a pretty steep learning curve. So what we say in permaculture is it's better to spend 100 hours thinking and 1 hour like actually working, so that you can really get your plan in place.
Sure.
This is not something that you want to rush into.
So what would you suggest in terms of the type of plants that you might utilize? I know you mentioned to me before the show about companion planting,
mm-hmm.
Or layers. I guess I'm looking for some of the techniques that are involved in this.
Yeah.
And it could be even watering as well.
Okay.
And maybe we'll touch, I know you mentioned gray water as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like to me, as I'm getting more clarity on this permaculture as we go through the conversation here, that it's a situation where you're starting to really have a self-contained system.
Yes. So we're self-containing. We're not creating any waste. We're using everything and seeing everything as a resource. And so for a home gardener, maybe two people are working in the home, you don't have a whole lot of time, but say you've always loved tomatoes, and maybe your mom and dad or your grandparents used to grow tomatoes, and they were the best tomatoes you ever ate.
Right.
Right. And so you go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
You go to the grocery store and those tomatoes just aren't as good. You know, you avoid buying tomatoes now. So I think a really good place for people to start is with a tomato plant, because you can plant one plant. You can take care of that plant. It's not going to be overwhelming for you. You can read about it. You can care for it each day, look out on it, and you can be pretty successful. Now, if you feel like you're a little bit more advanced than that, or you want to dive in a little deeper and a little more quickly, then you could start looking into companion planting. And you can do it in the same pot. Say you're going to create a one pot tomato salad garden.
Okay.
So let's put a tomato plant in there. And then what goes good with tomatoes, David? I mean, culinarily speaking.
Lettuce.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Some herbs.
Yeah, like basil. Tomatoes and basil. Yeah.
Right. Onions.
Onions,
Peppers.
Peppers go great, absolutely.
Trying to think of some exotic things that we could still grow.
Radish.
Radish. Oh, right.
Radish goes really good. You said carrots, right?
No, I didn't, but carrots, of course.
Carrots, yeah. And these
celery, are... I don't know if we're getting... That's a tough one, maybe, because...
Well, let's put celery off to the next lesson. But I think we have enough in that pot right now. The only other thing that I would want to add is sweet potatoes. Only because that's a really good long-term crop that can be growing in the bottom and hanging over the edges. The leaves will hang over the edges, help shade the pot itself and keep that soil temperature cool. And you can also eat the leaves. Not all of them, but you could pick a few leaves here and there and add them to your salad for more nutrition and, you know, keep that for that layer of vegetation that we need it to fulfill. So the layers of vegetation, you typically have an overstory plant, which in our container is going to be the tomato because it's going to get pretty big.
So you said overstory.
Overstory.
Meaning
in a forest, it's going to be the tall trees, the overstory.
Okay.
And then in the forest, you also have the understory, which are the shorter trees that grow under the bigger trees for protection or because that's just their habitat. You have the bushy layer. Then you have the perennial layer, which is like other herbs and flowers and plants that will grow under the bushes or around the bushes. You have the rhizosphere layer, which are the root zone vegetables or plants that grow underground primarily. I mean, you'll see they're above ground, but the product is going to be like potatoes or sweet potatoes underground.
Right.
And then you have your vine layer. So the vines that either sprawl out on the ground, or if they have tendrils, they'll climb up other things, or they may wrap their vines around things to hang on and grow up.
So that is kind of the container aspect of it. When I was in this seminar, one of the things that we took a little bit of time to do is to design a garden. And some of the considerations were accessibility. So pathways were created or designed so that you could easily get into those areas,
mm-hmm.
Along with different plants that might be compatible, as we talked about a second ago, with the plants that are being grown there, as well as the watering aspect of it, and just the maintenance of removing weeds or whatever else that you might have to do with that.
Right. Well, did you want to talk about companion planting?
Because I think we should touch on that because...
Companion planting is growing things together that like to grow together, that give that support each other in some way, or to have some sort of a benefit.
Kind of a symbiotic relationship where each is getting different benefits from the other.
Yes, like you
providing
might
providing benefits.
Right, you might want to plant some flowering plants that will bring in predatory insects to keep the pest population down. Or plants that will bring in the pollinators to help you with the pollination, stuff like that. Or you may plant things like marigolds that would secrete something into the soil to keep the nematodes away. So companion planting, taking advantage of the different microclimates created by the plants that are in the system.
So they're actually creating their own microclimates to the benefit of this companion.
Right. If we get back to our pot with the tomato, we might want to put some spinach in there, but spinach likes to grow in shade. It can't take too much sun. So we would want to plant the spinach plant behind the tomato plant, which would be on the north side, because the sun doesn't really ever reach to the north side.
Right.
So then we start microclimatizing the actual pot that we're planting in. The things that need more sun, like the peppers, they will go on the west side because they can take that higher heat in the afternoon, the hot western sun.
And then if you have a garden, you're probably in terms of the design aspect, you probably want to take into account, like you were mentioning, the sun.
Yeah.
And not just the amount of sun or the direction that you're getting it from, but also how these various plants might shade some plants and give a little more sunshine. And
So on your property, everything that we're talking about in the pot can be applied directly to your landscape. So here in the northern hemisphere, you want to put the taller trees or bushes or plants, if you're doing a garden, to the north, because if you put them on the south, they're going to shade out everything. So let's put the tall things to the north. Maybe you're going to grow a few rows of corn in a bigger garden.
Right.
Definitely on the north side.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what, in terms of, I'm just thinking, a lot of us have orchards, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be anything from apple trees to citrus to stone fruits.
Yeah.
We had... Dave Wilson's nursery guy here talking about this and about planting. Normally we used to plant fruit trees with a good amount of separation, and he's actually encouraging you to plant varieties of apple trees together in a closer proximity, as close as 18 inches.
Yeah, and that's really good for the home garden because we don't usually have a whole lot of space.
Right.
And this is one way to keep trees smaller and also to get more variety. Say you plant four different types of apple trees and you put them all in the same hole, or you plant them like in a quad 18 inches apart.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
It does a lot to mitigate the size and give you an extended harvest.
So now, what are some examples of things that we could plant below that or around that to take advantage of this permaculture idea?
So this is the bigger companion planting. This is actually called creating a guild. So if you're a tree guild. So a guild in nature are plants and animal associations that like to hang out together. So you'll typically see a tree in nature, and then you'll see its understory plants and herbaceous level and so on and so forth underneath it. And you'll also see the animals that like to come and visit that tree and that guild. So if we wanted to create an apple tree guild on our property, we could plant things like comfrey underneath it, because comfrey is a dynamic accumulator. Comfrey has a very deep tap root. It dives way down into the subsoil and it brings up nutrients into its foliage. And then you can use that after you've enjoyed the flowers. You can chop and drop that and use it for mulch around your tree. And those leaves are going to break down and release all those nutrients back into the soil for your plant. You could plant things like artichoke. That's a really good companion plant for the tree guild, because again, it's going to give you a yield, but it's also going to, of artichokes, but it's also going to be, those leaves are going to be really good mulch for your apple tree. You can plant bulbs like crocus. Crocus are good. And why not plant a saffron crocus? Because especially if you're trying to plant a fruit tree where grass is growing, or where grass used to be, particularly, you know, the grass that grows on stolons and runners underneath the ground, that's very invasive. So you want to stop that. And a really good way to stop that grass from invading your tree guild is to plant bulbs all the way around it.
Right. Right.
So, yep.
Well, that's great. We're getting close to the half hour mark, but we got another quick question here.
Okay.
We're going to ask you, as far as, do you see most homeowners get lightened up by this? I mean, enlightened by this? Do they really, have you had experiences with people? And what are some of the issues that they've encountered and some of the crazy stuff that they've had to deal with?
Well, I get people calling me asking me about, you know, just straight up landscape design, how to make their properties look really pretty, but maybe be a little bit more sustainable and water wise.
Right.
And then I get people also calling me who have heard about permaculture and they want to go all in, and they get really, really excited about everything that they can do. So I guess currently people are really interested in trying to save water, trying to maximize their resources, trying to become a little bit more sustainable. And so through design, I'm actually able to help these people accomplish some of their goals. But I have seen people light up and get really happy and excited about it. And then as we go through the process, see them get overwhelmed.
Sure,
and then
sure.
I counsel them and say, okay, well, let's just start small and let's do this one thing and then build on there. And then they go, okay.
Right, right.
Because,
I mean, you mentioned doing the container thing as a starting point as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was thinking is, you know, those containers, you could also move them around, and some people actually put casters.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially where I live in the desert, because, you know, it could be a really nice morning with just the right amount of sunlight, but if you leave the pot there, you know, in the afternoon when it gets to 110, it's not going to do as well. So you need to be able to move your pot into the shade. Or likewise, if it gets too cold, you could roll it into the garage or the shed or into your house if you need to.
I don't know if you've ever been to France, to Versailles. One of the things, you know, that was King Louis XIV, I think it was, his palace. And while we were there in the middle of winter, they showed us citrus trees that they would pull into the palace where it's warmer, and then push them to the outside during the summer months so they could get oranges and grapefruits and whatnot. We're going to take a quick pause here for a moment to do a station identification. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org online. This is In the Garden, show produced by UC Manister Gardeners of Orange County. I'm David Letourneau, your host, and my guest today is Susan Krings, and we're talking about permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other aspects that we could discuss?
Well, let's talk about, I mean, we started about talking about tomatoes in a pot with their companions. Let's talk about citrus, because you just mentioned, you know, putting citrus in a pot on casters, wheeling it in.
Right.
Citrus is really great. It's a very reliable crop. Citrus is the most grown and harvested crop throughout the whole world. There is more citrus is produced than any other tree crop, especially, you know, if you combined all the stone fruit crops together. It doesn't even make up as much citrus as is grown throughout the world. So citrus is very adaptable. It can grow very well in a pot. It takes very well to pruning, and it doesn't at the same time need that much pruning. So you don't really have to be an expert to start with a fruit tree if you choose citrus.
And we're in one of the best environments for the citrus fruits.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It should be somewhat easier. I mean, you know, I think of apple trees, and I asked Tom Spellman with Dave Wilson Nurseries about growing them in containers, and he pretty much poo-pooed the idea because it's really a challenge.
Yeah.
But going back to citrus, it's so easy, and the great thing is the weather here it's so ideal, and it's just wonderful to have fresh oranges and fresh grapefruits and fresh lemons.
What about like a little Meyer lemon tree in a pot?
Right.
Because they stay small anyway. They're a very nice variety. And then you could actually create a little citrus tree guild with your Meyer lemon. And I have one of those. I can tell you about it.
Okay. That'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. So what I do is I plant things underneath my little Meyer lemon tree. It's in a big pot. It's on casters, so I can roll it around. And I put sweet alyssum in there in the pot with it. I planted sweet alyssum with it. So that's going to attract beneficial insects. It's going to attract pollinators and parasitics so that I can have some pest control. And I also take my water that I use to rinse my beans with. And so I'm using a gray water system, a very low-tech gray water system. I carry that bowl of water out to my citrus tree, and I water it. But sometimes some of the beans or the peas or whatever is in there, it goes into my canner.
Into that container as well.
Yeah, so I always have little surprise bean plants growing up through my citrus tree. Now, not only am I getting a yield from something that I didn't really even try for, I'm getting some beans, but I'm also getting that nitrogen fixing that a bean or a pea plant will do. So in the bean and pea family, they will actually fix nitrogen from the atmosphere into the soil. So they pull it in. And nitrogen is one of the most limiting factors of production. So we're always trying to get more nitrogen in. So we need to be cognizant of planting beans and peas around our plants. Whether it's, you know, a vining thing that, you know, a green bean, or it could be a tree that is in the same family.
Right. And that goes back to that companion planting idea. I mean, it's sort of obvious, but I just wanted to emphasize that because it takes a little bit of thought to select various plants and to find out what the compatibility. I think there's even website information out there that you could look for that you pull up these various tomato plants, let's say, and you would find maybe basil as a companion.
Right. Well, these days you can just type in companion plant for tomato.
Okay.
And it'll come right up for you.
Sure.
Or how to create a citrus tree guild, and bam, you'll get a bunch of resources come right up.
And the nice thing about containers is the fact that you don't have to have these huge, tall trees.
Right.
That when Southern California was being developed with the housing aspect of it, a lot of people ended up buying homes that were formerly in orchards, and they'd leave a couple of the orange trees there, or people would buy these orange trees and they would get to be 20, 30 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And you could never, the most average homeowners could never access all the fruit to take
it
off.
Right. It actually becomes a hazard for homeowners because they'll get up there on their ladders and try to harvest the fruit, and it's just not a safe good thing to do.
Right. Yeah. And then we get rats and squirrels, and we're feeding that population.
Right. So for the home garden, especially in your landscape, if you want to plant fruit trees, they really shouldn't be over 6 feet tall.
Right.
Any taller than you can reach with your hands, because you don't want to be up on a ladder. So what you can do for that is, you know, plant trees either closer together so they have more competition and they don't grow as big. You can prune them very heavily. so that they don't get big. A lot of people say don't top your tree, but you can top a tree if it's for a specific reason and keep it small.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So what else can you do with that? Yeah, you just want to make it easy for yourself.
Right. And we're actually seeing a lot of commercial growers. They're now reducing the size of the trees, and they're actually able to grow them closer.
Yeah.
And they've got even smaller tractor equipment, if you will, that allows them to now go into a narrower row, mm-hmm. but also not have to deal with getting up on ladders and people falling off
right.
and getting injured.
Well, there's an interesting story that a farm advisor came and talked to the Master Gardeners of Riverside County last month, and he said, you know, he was out advising on this avocado orchard, and these trees were 50, 60 feet tall.
Right.
And the workers were getting out there with their huge ladders. They didn't even have the lift bucket, but they were climbing up these ladders, climbing in the trees, and the insurance adjuster came out for a visit.
Oh, boy.
And I think they even expected him to come out, and they didn't think anything of it because this is how they'd been harvesting for years. But right. what happened is he said, nope, not anymore. And he shut them down. He goes, no, I can't insure this anymore. We
right.
can't do it. And so the farm advisors took 2 or 3 years trying to figure out how to help the avocado industry, basically. And so what they came up with is they pruned these trees down to like 3 feet tall. They could they basically cut the tree down.
Right.
And then they started interplanting with others. So they started planting the trees closer together. The large trees that they had cut down sprouted and were producing again within, I think, a year or two. And it was so much, they kept them short. It was so much easier. They got even more production than
probably
they were getting.
Higher yield,
right. more trees, smaller spaces. Yeah, it was a win-win. So this is where I learned that it's really okay to top the tree, especially if you're trying to keep it into this certain boundary and keep it functional and safe for your
sure.
family.
Now, one thing I was going to touch on, unless I'm getting out of sequence here a little bit, is gray water. Because
yeah.
gray water is a huge buzz. There's a lot of buzz about gray water these days
yeah.
because we have in Southern California a constant concern about drought.
Yeah,
and
constant drought situation.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. And we've had rainfall this year, but not to the levels that we would expect them to be. And this is an area that I think can be easily taken advantage of as far
oh,
as...
Oh, absolutely. Well, we produce so much gray water from our homes
right.
that it's a no-brainer to plant some trees out in the landscape and water them with the gray water. You don't want to water your annual vegetable garden with gray water. It's only for trees.
Right.
Only for
okay.
trees. Yeah.
Okay.
And it can be fruit trees.
But now how are you accessing these water sources, this runoff? I mean, we have a... energy efficient washing machine, so it uses less water.
Yeah.
And I often wonder, does that mean that the rinse water that's part of this process, is it going to have more soap in the water or elements that might be...
It's going to have more nutrients in it.
It's more nutrients.
Yeah, more
okay.
nutrients. Now
okay.
you have to buy the biodegradable soap.
Okay.
So you when you do, it's called the laundry to landscape system. So you hook up your washer with a valve. So if you want to put it back to sewer, say you want to use a harsh chemical or
like
a different
bleach
bleach or a Tide or something, you can send it out to the sewer. But if you want to use a gentle biodegradable or just run something through a rinse cycle,
right.
you can send that out to the landscape and it can be watering your tree.
But how are you getting that out there?
Well, you have to pipe it.
Okay.
Yeah, you
okay.
have to install the system. But with laundry to landscape, you can do it yourself without a permit.
Right. It seems like it's pretty easy to do.
It is. And you can go to your water agency, your local water agency, and they should have examples and instructions online for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to send your shower or sink water out to the landscape, you
right.
need to get a plumber in there to do that because they have to cut into... You know, some pretty serious pipes under your house.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you put a diverter valve, I think,
mm-hmm.
on there. So when you do want to run waters that are more contaminated, if you will.
Right. Or have harsh chemicals that would kill your plant. I mean, if you sent bleach out to your tree, that's not going to be
right.
good for it.
So do they utilize that system on both the bathroom I don't think the shower would be so much of an issue, but...
Oh, yeah, you can use it on your shower and your sinks. Your toilet, of course, would not go onto that. That's black water.
Black water,
yeah,
correct.
So we don't do that. That always goes out to the sewer. I think dishwasher water is also considered black water and kitchen sink water, so they don't. I don't think they would plumb that out there. But definitely the shower. Shower is a really great source of water.
Without getting too technical... Most of the homes that are built here in Southern California are built on a cement slab
mm-hmm.
with the plumbing running through that slab. Is it easy to...
No, it's not.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So in that case, the easiest thing to do, or maybe the only source of gray water, would be the laundry to landscape.
Sure.
Because you can... in my case, I cut through the wall because my washer was in the garage, so I just cut through the garage wall and piped it out.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there are low-tech ways to do gray water. I have a pitcher sitting by my sink, and I pour in the old dog water. I pour in any old water that I haven't finished or whatever. I take that out and water the plants.
So
I have a bucket in my shower for warm-up water. I take that out and use it.
Do you do any saving of the water in, let's say, a rain barrel? Because if you start putting...
I do.
You know, depending on what's in that water, you could have algae grow or some type of fungus, possibly. I don't know if you're...
Yeah, I had that last year. My rainwater turned green, and it didn't hurt my plants a bit.
Okay.
It was fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was fine. But, yeah, last year I had a collapsible rain barrel because I live out near Palm Springs, and so we hardly get any rain. And if we do, it's going to be in December and January. So we got a little bit that I could catch in December.
Right.
Last year, I got a lot of water. But this year, I didn't get hardly any. And then it rained. It rained a few days ago, and it sprinkled. And I thought, come on down, fill up my rain barrel. And it
not doing it.
No, it made the dust on the rain barrel just kind of muddy.
Okay. So let's get back to permaculture. What kind of resources could people, are you aware of seminars, or is there like a certification program if people wanted to do this?
Sure. I can tell you about the two classes that I took.
Okay.
Yeah. I went with, Warren Brush up at Quail Springs, which is, right above, it's pretty kind of inland from Santa Barbara, if you will, California. There's a permaculture demonstration site up there in school, and those people do an amazing job. There's a whole team of teachers up there teaching everything from natural building to building a food forest. I mean, it's a whole 72-hour course on permaculture. You go there and you stay there for 2 weeks and do that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you camp out. Yeah, it's really amazing. And then the second course I took was with Jeff Lawton, and I did his class online, and he's... continues to do his online certifications, and it's a really high quality certification, really good product. So I love both of my teachers and the education that I got. And you can look online if you live somewhere else or want to do something in person. There are teachers everywhere. There are literally thousands of us, and I'll be teaching at some point and setting up classes, so you can just look on Susan's Edible Garden is my Facebook page.
Okay.
So you can keep in touch with me that way.
Susan's Edible Garden on Facebook.
On Facebook.
Are you aware of any physical sites nearby in, I know you're out in Riverside area, but in Orange County or Los
I'm
Angeles
really,
even?
I'm really not. And that's what we really need to get more into is finding places where people want to set up permaculture demonstration sites, because it's really a long-term commitment. Permaculture sees things in, we do 500 and 1,000 year plans. It's not just for, our family right now.
Right.
But what is hard is like trying to find a space that is committed to being just that for 500 years. I mean, even for 100 years.
Right.
At this point, even
for 20 years.
I would take 20 years at this point. But what it's hard to do is put all this time and energy and effort into, say, a community garden space where they may bulldoze it in a year.
Right.
Or two, or even 5 years, and the trees are just getting going. And it's heartbreaking. So What I'm holding out for is a space where it can be a common area that's going to be there for 500 years.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's this integration of this almost circle of life, if you will, that is so interesting and appealing to me on this. And I think from that perspective, I understand why you say it's a 500-year plan, basically.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's more of a deep time thing, you know, and which is what we strive to teach people and try to get people to understand is it's our lifetime is so short that we can really, if we can really start to think long term and think out and think in generations, like our Native Americans, they think in seven generations.
Wow.
You know, how can we be sustainable and even regenerative, if you will, like making things better, making things more productive for generations to come, instead of, you know, blowing off mountaintops just to get out the resource that might be under there, and then, you know, that whole area is unusable for the next generations.
Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of this society that we live in today, and I'm not trying to get too out there with this, is it's sort of this, we use it and throw it away.
Yeah. It's always going to the landfill. It's going away. I don't have to worry about the trash, or I'm recycling, you know.
Right.
But then we have to think, even if we're recycling, there's still a lot of energy and a lot of wasted resources that go into, you know, all that packaging that we're continuing. It's like being on the rat on the treadmill.
Right. You trade off one thing for another. In some regards, I mean, you may get fresh tomatoes, but they're being trucked in from somewhere. So there's that carbon footprint.
The carbon footprint, the ecological footprint.
Right. Then there's the containers.
The social aspect of it, you know, the way that our current economic system really favors this whole global economy that really is leaving a lot of local towns and cities and peoples impoverished in order to be, if you will, you know, like servants to this whole system.
Yeah.
So if we can bring things way back to a local level, local economy, and seeing our local resources as very vital and meaningful, and the work that we do on a local level, very meaningful. And even as local as your own home, I mean, what about the people who are unemployed or underemployed, and they are feeling very badly about themselves because they don't have a job, and so they're sitting at home depressed? I mean, what could they be doing with permaculture design and with a garden at home that would bring so much wealth to their family?
Right. Just in interaction, as well as, you know, you have a food source that's inexpensive
and nutrient dense and with no carbon footprint.
Right.
Yeah. Very, very, very healthy. Healthy physically, emotionally, and socially.
Right. Yeah. I just recently got back from a trip to Cuba, and we talked about this briefly before the interview, and the fact that most of their food is all organic because they don't have the monies for petroleum products that might be used for fertilizers or pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what a great idea or system this would be. But you told me that at one point Cuba was saved a little bit with this.
With permaculture.
Right.
Yeah. In the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union fell, Cuba was completely dependent on oil from the USSR. And so overnight, pretty much their lights just went out. They had no fossil fuel. The people of Cuba were starving. They called it the special period because there was just nothing was coming into the island.
They actually, you know, you see a lot of these old vintage cars there.
Yeah.
A lot of those have been modified to either have a diesel engine placed into them, and that could be a tractor motor,
mm-hmm.
because the limitation on gasoline was really tough there.
Yeah, they just didn't have any. And right. So, I mean, people were eating, they were trying to grow things, but like we talked about earlier, they had kind of forgotten how to do their own home garden.
Right.
People were eating the zoo animals. I mean, it was really, really serious. And
right.
So the people, the permaculture people down in Australia were looking at Cuba and they're going, oh my goodness, nobody's helping them.
Right.
So
because of this embargo then.
Yeah.
Right.
And so they got hopped on a plane, they came over, they brought what they could, and they started teaching people. And because of that, Cuba is the most sustainable country in the world. Like, they are living on real-time sunlight as
right.
much as they possibly can, which is really the goal of every living thing,
right.
to live on real-time sunlight. And that's where security, real security, comes from. Real self-sustainability
right.
comes from that. And that's what really makes each and every one of us a billionaire, if you will, because that's how much energy that we can get and how much wealth we can create from working with real-time sunlight.
Exactly. And one of the things I noticed there, and I'm not sure this is a result of this, but it's a poor country, but I didn't see that abject poverty that
right.
you see, for example, in Haiti. Or Nicaragua, maybe even El Salvador. I'm not sure of all the different areas, but these are typically areas where people, like you said, have forgotten how to do it, how
right.
to grow things.
Right.
So
I think it really starts at the family level, especially in a first world country. We have so much going for us.
Right.
We have so many resources. Even if we are poor, or if we feel poor economically, we can walk down the street and gather so many resources, enough to make a garden for ourselves.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, plants are inexpensive. Seeds are next to nothing.
Yeah. And you can probably come and talk to a master gardener.
Right.
Yeah. And you can get resources, because we always have seeds to share.
That's true.
It's true.
That's true.
Yeah.
We're getting close to the end of our time here, but I just wanted to summarize and review with you this permaculture idea and the many benefits, not just of increased plant production, but also the interaction that you have out in the garden, which we all know about is a great thing, but community wise, I mean, there's that aspect of it.
Yeah.
So if you could just maybe emphasize or just touch on some of the things that we talked about, just to summarize and help our folks understand this as best they can.
Well, I guess I would like to start by encouraging people to take their next best step in their garden. Just get started, because it's such an important fabric for family life and security and for community. It really will teach you how to utilize your resources to the best. It'll teach you a lot about where things come from, how things are processed and produced, and about recycling and about regeneration.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. One thing we didn't talk about, it just came to mind, was animals.
Yeah.
As part of the system.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all components that we've been talking about that contribute to this permaculture idea.
Yeah.
Some folks have chickens.
Right.
And they're in areas that you think you probably shouldn't have chickens, but a lot of cities now are embracing this idea of having
yeah.
people having two or three chickens on their property. So you have the benefit of the eggs, but
right.
you have the benefit of these chicken workers, if you
yeah,
will, in your garden.
You can absolutely put animals to work for you doing what they love to do, what they naturally do. Their chickens are great at pest control. They're great about conditioning the soil. They give you fertilizer for growing your plants.
Right.
They'll clean up your garden at the end of the season. They'll eat the weed seeds. They're really good. And so if we can learn to look at all animals, even wild animals and insects that come into our space, as our friends and as our helpers, then we have tremendous amount of resources right there as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because I know with chickens, they're scratching the ground. They're,
yeah.
they're picking up grubs, they're
yeah
like you said, they're providing that extra fertilizer that
yeah so you can start to see that things like a grub, oh my goodness, I got to get rid of it. No, now it becomes a resource. Or that weed that you're like, oh, I can't get rid of that weed, let me get the chemicals out. No, the chicken's gonna dig it up, eat it, scratch it out, take care of it, and then give you some eggs.
Right.
So all
right.
of these things that we have learned to hate or battle or, you know, fight against. It's no longer a fight. It's like, wow, that's just another resource for me, right. And I need that.
See, I want to ask you real quick, and we're getting really close here on our timing, but I wanted to ask you about the aquaponic part of it.
Oh, okay.
That sounds intriguing to me,
uh-huh.
But is it a realistic aspect of this?
Well, absolutely. Aquaponics involves the raising of fish and plants together. Hydroponics is just the plants being raised on chemicals in a water solution. So right. That creates a waste product. So what we want to do is we want to get the fish and the plants together. The fish waste feeds the plants, and the plants clean the water for the fish. So again, it's how much do you want to get involved? You could use the fish as a food resource if you want to harvest it for that, or you could simply use them as a source of food for your plants.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So are you able to put in kitchen waste, water waste into this system, or is that?
No. Okay. You don't want to do that.
Okay.
You want to send out that kitchen waste out in the gray water to your trees.
Okay.
Any kitchen waste you want to put in the worm bin if
right.
it goes in there, or feed it to the chickens, or put it in the compost pile.
And that's something that we didn't really talk about, was composting.
Yeah.
And vermiculture, which I think, you know, sometimes people feel like, hey, I can't do this big compost pile because I don't have a lot of materials.
Right.
Living in the areas that we do with Southern California.
Oh, but you could walk down the street and pick up so much.
That's
or from
true
your
too.
Neighbors, you grow the grass, or when the leaves drop, you can get some brown material, you can get cardboard and newspaper. There's just so many resources in the city.
That's true.
I mean, not limited. David, we have so much to talk about.
we might
have to get together again, because I would love to talk about compost and vermicomposting.
Right.
And
right. Because composting is a great garden product that you are constantly replenishing.
If you compost and mulch, you never have to buy chemical fertilizers again.
Right.
You create everything right on site. And in permaculture, this is what we strive for, these closed systems, so that you don't have to import things from the big box store. You can just, it's right there on site.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's so true. Well, we're getting to the end of our hour.
I think we've done it.
Yeah, I think we have. And it's been wonderful having you here, Susan.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
This is Susan Krings. And I want to mention your website again.
Well, you can find me on Facebook at Susan's Edible Garden.
Susan's Edible Garden.
And you can find me online. My website is permaculture-consulting.us.
Okay. And then, again, if you want to resource us a little bit farther or further, you can check into just Google and look under permaculture.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of resources. I looked at that briefly before the show, and there's some great things in there.
Very good things. Yeah. A lot to learn.
Well, this has been In the Garden with Susan Krings as our guest. I appreciate you sharing your expertise and time with us. I'd like to end the show with this reminder: gardeners live longer, healthier, and happier lives. So thank you for listening. This has been David Letourneau on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You've been listening to In the Garden. The show is produced every week on Thursdays from 8:30 until 9:30 a.m. Look for another green topic in the coming weeks. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.